Welcome to another episode of the Reboot Chronicles, a no-holds-barred forum with global leaders, authors, entrepreneurs, and CEOs about how organizations stay focused on growth and innovation in unprecedented times. I'm your host, Dean DeBias, coming to you live from Reviv's North American headquarters in Chicago, and we would like to thank you for joining us from around the globe today. I'd like to welcome John Chambers to the Reboot Chronicles. John is the former CEO of Cisco, founder and CEO of JC2 Ventures, board member of numerous tech companies, and chairman emeritus at Cisco. During his tenure at Cisco, it grew into about a $50 billion company, pretty much a market leader, as many of you know. And since starting JC2, he and his team have helped start, scale, and exit numerous tech companies, including a couple unicorns, I think. So we'll get into that maybe. He's received dozens of awards. This intro could go on forever. Just ones that I like were best performing CEOs in the world, CEO of the year, world's best CEOs, best boss in America. And well, you get the idea. And I got to know John in Silicon Valley when he was the when I was the CEO of AutoWeb, sorry. And we were both working together on tech competitive issues with two administrations and the U.S. Congress. And I have to tell you guys, he is the real deal. He's an amazing leader, remarkable coach, author of Connecting the Dots, where he shares startup lessons. And like me, he believes startups will be the driver of economic growth, job creation, innovation, and transformation across the globe. John, it's great to see you.
Dean, it's a pleasure to be with you again. The early days of TechNet, it was fun with John Doerr and Jim Barksdale, and we helped change an industry and be well-received in Washington and around the world. Thank you for your commitment. It's great to reconnect on the friendship.
Excellent. You're looking great. Let's go back. Let's go back to the good old days. You know, when you were at Cisco, I remember you saying you had 40 straight quarters of growth, over 50%. And I think you acquired about 180 or so companies along the way and turned it into a top brand. So, you know, most people know that story, but what I'd like to know is just how was that journey for you personally?
Well, it was a dream. When I went to school, my parents gave me a strong nudge about getting an education was the equalizer in life. And Dean later, literally setting up the internet and making it work well was the other equalizer in life for all of us to be able to be connected. It was something that I never imagined. I thought I would get a law degree and an MBA degree and a couple years of engineering at Duke as well. And then I'd do a small business. I ended up in the computer industry by a little bit of luck and went IBM, Wang, and then Cisco, a right spot at the right time. And what was it like personally? It's a lot of life's lessons. You know, and how I treated people earlier in my career was the reason I got the job at Cisco. Yeah. The doors got opened by somebody that I'd helped earlier, and they helped me when I was changing jobs. To grow from 400 people to 75,000 people, it is a rush.
Oh my gosh.
Along the way, growth covers up a lot of mistakes. Dean, yeah.
Thanks for admitting that. No, most people don't say that. That's great.
Yeah, well, it's an honest answer. And for 40 quarters in a row, we exceeded expectations every quarter, even though 80% of our business was new every quarter. You know what I'm saying by that. That means every quarter was a little bit stressful. But I had a great team and a great CFO and Larry Carter for the majority of the time. It was fun because it not only was economic success, and it might surprise you, one of the first things I think about is, did we give back most important to our customers? We had the top satisfaction in the industry for 20 years. How about to our employees? Among the best places to work, we created 10,000 millionaires, Dean, back when $1 million could buy you an unbelievably nice house in Silicon Valley on it. So we shared the success and we won every corporate social responsibility award there was, from Democratic presidents and secretaries of state to Republicans to Middle East to China to India. It was fun. But like many things, we'll probably hit on this later. While everybody loves talking about their successes, I also got knocked on my tail several times. And that's when you learn about leadership. It's something you wish you could avoid. And hopefully by sharing views, I can help others avoid it. But I often like to ask the question on my own podcast, are you more a product of your successes or more a product of your setbacks or failures? I think you're equally a product of both.
Well, that's a good one. I don't want to admit the answer. For me, so when you look at failures and you look at the second half of this decade, What advice would you give to, you know, the CEOs of Fortune 500s and their boards, quite frankly, about what should they be learning from the last, you know, decade or so, and how should they really be preparing their companies and their platforms for the future?
Well, you know, it's a great question. I'm going to break it into a couple parts. First, watch how the boards, whether you're a large company like JP Morgan Chase or GE or Walmart, or whether you're a startup, the answer is very similar. And you've got to change over time. During the 90s, what you need to be prepared for is every company is going to become an internet company. And if you didn't move to the internet, Fidelity, as an example, wouldn't invest in your company regardless of what your business model was.
Exactly.
Then you went through clouds. Then you went through today, artificial intelligence. So what the boards need to be thinking about today, the discussion's over, Dean, that when we at TechNet in the 90s, we'd go to Washington, we'd say every country will become a tech company, a digital company. Everybody gets that now.
They didn't believe us. We were still lobbying for not taxing the internet, for gosh sakes.
Yeah. And by the way, in fairness, regardless of whether you're a Democrat or Republican, President Clinton got that. He understood the role that the internet would play in the future of the country economically and competitiveness wise, much like Modi today gets the future of India, the prime minister there being about a digital India and the direction. And so what companies need to think about today is the speed is 3x what it was a decade ago. Artificial intelligence, for 7 years, I've been focused on artificial intelligence. And Dean, I always felt like maybe I was going to miss this window. I'm pretty good at pattern recognition and seeing around corners, mainly because I listen to customers. But I felt that AI would be the next big technology change. And I invested in six AI companies. By the way, the majority of them are unicorns today already in terms of startups. But until a year ago, the market didn't get it. Now the market gets it, and AI will be as transformative as they say. It will introduce a new generation of leaders in technology. It will disrupt a lot of traditional business. Just like the internet, its end goal will be beneficial. There'll be bumps along the way, including job displacement that we have to plan for. But the speed is the major thing to watch for the boards and the CEO. So I would argue that any country needs to become a digital country, an AI company. Every company does, and every board needs to understand the implications of that, both from AI and from cybersecurity angles as well. It's going to change the world in a positive way, Dean, but there are going to be some hurdles to get over.
Big time. And when you look at the different sectors, which ones are you most bullish about, or which ones are you the most bearish about? Meaning, who's going to get run over and who's going to win? I guess it really depends on execution. I know that, but yeah. I know you've got some favorite sectors. We'll get into JC2 in a minute.
Well, I think the sectors are often the first movers in technology. And they're the first movers because they know if they don't move, they get left behind. So financial services, whether you're a Bank of America, a JP Morgan Chase, retail, whether you're a Walmart or a Home Depot or a startup or an Amazon.com, there is no entitlement. If you don't change, you're going to get left behind. I see those sectors moving very rapidly. In terms of productivity advantage, all of us understand that when you call up your credit card company or call into a call center, it's a painful experience on it. And I think call centers and customer service is going to be the first huge application on AI to change with volume and capability. It's not uncommon to see a 50% improvement productivity there for both your resource costs, but your customer satisfaction goes up as well. So just like the internet, Dean, there are going to be certain areas that will be early movers within every industry, regardless of industry. Call centers is probably the front end. Don't end up trying to put AI and force fit it into an application your data is not in good shape yet to make the transitions on. So there'll be a series of application areas with very good payback that will have good disruption.
You know, I have this keynote on the Web3 and how the oligopolies really actually don't want the concept to happen. You know, the big four, the big six, however you count them. And what are your thoughts about the promise of Web3, democratization of the internet, those next generation models?
Well, you know, there are several thoughts. Dean, you and I have seen multiple generations of technology.
Yes,
and
sir.
It doesn't matter if the mainframe era where IBM dominated, the minicomputer era where Wang and DEC dominated, the PC era where IBM actually did a very key role, and Microsoft, the internet.
They started it. Yeah, exactly. Dominated,
the cloud where Amazon and Microsoft and Google and Meta are dominating. The point I'm making is usually the leaders change. And it's hard for a leader to reinvent themselves, both as the CEO, but also as a company. This one may be a little bit different because I'm seeing these big five tech companies actually move pretty rapidly, especially on AI, once they finally decided to move. They didn't move because they wanted to lead the next generation technology. They moved because, if they didn't move, they're going to get left behind.
Right.
And I think Microsoft's move on OpenAI really was a wake-up call to Google. And when then they woke up, the whole universe woke up there in November, December, January.
Yeah, it was emergency board meeting time for sure. That was
every time.
Yeah, it's. I mean, I have mixed feelings about this because, you know, you and I both believe that startups is the next generation growth, innovation, transformation, jobs,
yes.
Countries is really hopefully out of startups. But at the same time, you do have a lot of consolidation in tech. And it seems like from the entrepreneurial point of view, it is really tough to break in. Unlike back in the, you know, early 90s and early 2000s, where like there could be 15 in one sector. Now it's so I'm a little concerned about that. You know, I mean, you've talked about consolidation in cloud. That's obviously, you look at Amazon, Google, and Oracle and Microsoft. I didn't even add Salesforce in there, though. It's a sliver. And then on the consumer side, you know, Apple, Google, Microsoft, Facebook, even things like Samsung. But when I talk to entrepreneurs, and you talk to probably 20 of them a day, they seem they just don't seem as confident because what did we call it in the 60s? The man is putting them down. You know, the big, I'll use the word again, oligopoly overhang there is that something to worry about in terms of what we're going to do in the next 10 years? Because we really do need the next entrepreneurial revolution.
Well, I think in the long run, startups will be the only major job creator. Large companies in total in the U.S. and around the world will not add headcount over the next two decades in total. Because of the automation that occurs. Most of the innovation comes from startups, and even the big five that you mentioned, they do a lot of their innovation by acquiring startups.
Exactly.
Plays in it. They play kind of hardball in terms of how they deal with small competitors at times. But if I were betting on the next AI generation of leaders, and I have 21 startups, 9 unicorns out of 21, which is pretty good for a very small firm, often when I do founders or Series A or B investment on it. But I would bet 2 or 3 startups will be out of the total package of 4 or 5 major AI companies, 2 or 3 will be by startups. I think it's important the government does not let the big players overrun the small players in innovation
right.
or gain competitive advantage because of their economic strength within that. But I'm still the optimist that fast will beat the slow, and big companies hate to disrupt their business model. So I think you will probably see out of the next 5 major AI players, 3 of them be startups of today.
Yeah, I started this program at Kellogg Northwestern. It's called Dancing with Startups. Then we commercialize it. So, we help the big dogs actually partner with startups around the globe, like companies like yours, so they can, accelerate their growth and innovation, but not always through acquisition. There's other, as you know, many, many, many business models. So, I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful there.
I am too. If you look at it, 2 things you hit on, Dean. First, big companies have to reinvent themselves. It's hard. Their DNA is just keep doing the right thing for too long and incremental improvement.
You know what they have? They have muscle memory instead of, what did you call yourself when you're trend hopping?
Disruptor, yeah. You get disrupted type of approach.
They're too much stuck on muscle memory, which is really the wrong thing. You're repeating what you used to do versus grabbing the next thing. Yeah.
I would agree, Dean, but even at Kellogg, go back 20 years, they trained us to do an MBA school, do a 5 to 7% increase in productivity per year, and you've got it nailed. That's what GE did so well under Jack Welch.
Doesn't cut it anymore.
No, you've got to innovate yourself, but you've got to realize that innovation will come largely from startups. So partnering with startups, being an integral part of that, is key. One that your viewers would get a storytelling example is you talk about AI and how AI has been largely accepted and publicized over the last year. But the postal service in France, La Poste, basically the CEO there, focused his organization of 250,000 people on AI 6 years ago. They saw their business model of delivering 18 billion pieces of mail going down to 6 billion. They saw the services they provide commoditize, new competitors coming in, and they reinvented their company. They acquired three AI companies. They trained 230,000 postal workers in France and around the world on AI, not as a threat, but saying, here's how we have to change. And they are one of the most innovative government agencies I've ever seen in my life and one of the most trusted brands. It says AI is going to be for everyone. You change or you die. But the big companies who survive, and you and I both know out of the Fortune 500, 40 or 50% of them will be gone in 15 years.
Exactly. Maybe less survive, this time. Yeah, by the way, France, if France can do that, anyone can do it. I mean, that to turn that so quick. But that brings
a lot of Christopher Macron on that. He got it.
It was all him. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I know you've been very involved there too. You know, that kind of brings up the American competitiveness, something I worry about a lot. And you work on this day in and day out with TechNet. But, yes. You know, when I look at India, I used to be very, very encouraged. You're very close to the Prime Minister and others. But as China kind of has cleaned our clock, I wonder, India's always been the best place to work. It's got the rule of law. It's got all the things that China doesn't have. But I guess I'll just throw a question here instead. What is your view of American competitiveness and what do you think we should be doing?
Okay. I think American competitiveness tends to go in waves. Mm. And much like in the 90s, you look at the startups that just had a tremendous economic run, and the big names in tech were formed in the late 80s and 90s, early 2000. We were clearly the leader. Silicon Valley, I had probably 75% of the venture capital investments in the U.S. in the Valley, and we delivered. I think we got a little bit overconfident. And you saw other sections around the world pick up steam. Agreed. I bet on China in 1995. It was a good bet. Worked out very well for me at Cisco. I bet on India in a big way as the second world headquarters for Cisco. And then I'm chairman of the U.S.-India Strategic Partnership Forum. I think India will be the largest economy in the world. And when I said that on Prime Minister Modi's visit in Washington just about a month and a half ago, it was like front page news. To me, it's obvious. You've got 1.4 billion people. You have the democracy. You're learning to innovate. You're the fastest growing startup and unicorn engine in the world, et cetera. And you're partnering with the U.S. for both countries to win together in a very unique way, which the head of the U.S. and President Biden and the head of India and Prime Minister Modi said this is the most strategic relationship for our citizens that is going to be done over the next 2 to 3 decades. And I agree with them. I think India wins big time. I think the U.S. wins big time. I actually am more comfortable with American innovation now than I've been in probably a decade. You're seeing the number of unicorns increase even during a tough time.
Right.
You're seeing China decrease dramatically to your earlier point. If you would say who's going to win both economically and startups and innovation-wise 5 years ago, most people would have said China. I would have said 10 years ago. I think China has misstepped. I think they've gone to too much of a state-controlled innovation engine. I think they misplayed their hands on their economy. I think they moved away from empowering citizens. And I'm a huge believer in China and the Chinese citizens. I work for Wang Laboratories. Dr. Wang was the most brilliant I ever met in my life. And I learned a large part of China operations. But I actually think China's in trouble, not just economically in terms of growth, their major policies, the one-child policy, their population is going to go from 1.3 billion to 700 million. India is going to go from 1.4 billion to 2 billion plus. India is partnering with transparency, startups, et cetera. And it takes 5 to 10 years to get a startup engine going, but they're on fire. And they're partnering with the U.S. uniquely. The U.S., the startup engine is well and live. Government, I think, has always realized, regardless of political party, that you've got to have a strong tech industry. and supportive of that tech industry. And there are ways that tech industry, especially the social players in tech industry, need to do a better job of giving back to society. But that's a comment for another time. So actually, I feel the best about American tech I felt in probably a decade and a half. I am the most optimistic on India, and anybody who follows me know that I bet on Prime Minister Modi when he came to office, and I felt they would be the most innovative nation in the world over the next several decades. They'll have the fastest growing GDP, the fastest increase in standard of living, and candidly, the best relationship with America, with the India diaspora here, and a win-win partnership. So I'm big on India. If you're betting on one country in Asia, bet on India. If you're betting on two, bet on India twice. I'm big on the strategic partnerships, countries learning to work together in a unique way they've never done before for the benefit of their citizens, both in and everything from healthcare to defense to economic growth, et cetera. And I believe on technology becoming the equalizer in life on a global basis overall. So very optimistic about how the U.S. is positioned. Candidly pessimistic about China, the way they played their hand. They'll eventually correct. And eventually the U.S. will get back along with China, as will India as well. But right now, I bet on, candidly, wild cards are no longer wild cards. India, U.S., and France are my top three bets in Asia, North America, and Europe, respectively.
Yeah, most of the startups that come by my laptop are India and Singapore. Very aggressive, very good growth. And I think you're right. China did us a favor by overplaying their hand. And now American corporations and startups and boards are on guard, and they're coming up with contingency plans. Some of that includes India.
I don't want my startups doing business in China. I've been very direct with them. It's not a level field. You can't protect intellectual property ship. India grew at 22% in terms of startup growth.
Right.
You become unicorns. France grew the last year at 19. China only grew at 6. You and I both know unicorns or IPO are an indication of future tech leadership. So I think we're seeing very early signs that China is losing its leadership.
Yep. So let's pivot to that. Let's talk, you started JC2 Ventures. Everyone knows what that means, your initials. So you've got 21.
Yeah.
I guess. So you've got 21 startups, 9 are unicorns. Everybody wants to know what the hell's your secret?
Well, I was lucky in training. I learned the combination of IBM, Wang, and then Cisco. You either disrupt yourself or you get left behind. At Cisco, you would probably Dean say, and I think that would as well, we invented innovation by doing acquisitions at a time most people felt acquisitions would not work in strategic partnerships. We ended up
almost 200 acquisitions. You guys were a machine.
Yeah, they've probably done over 200 now, 180 when I was there, two-thirds of which worked well. We led, I can say the word dominate now, I couldn't back then.
Two-thirds is a good number, by the way. That's actually a good hit rate.
We were number one in 12, number two in 3, and number 3 in 3. That's never been done before or
much
since.
Better than Google, by the way. Their hit rate has not been as pristine.
Well, you've got to have a playbook, Dean, to execute. And for the listeners, whether you're a large company or a small company, it's not magical. You get a playbook that you run faster and faster, including what you look for in acquisitions, what you look for in startups. And that's really my secret. I think I'm good on pattern recognition. I'm dyslexic, so I'm lousy at English, terrible at spelling. But I've learned when you get knocked on your butt, which I did clearly with being dyslexic, when you learn to get up and learn to compensate and then actually make it a strength, it makes you stronger. And I think the playbooks on innovation, the playbooks on what makes startups successful, the playbook on acquisitions, you can run with speed. And in connecting the dots too, that's what I tried to really hit with playbooks that are replicatable.
So one of your JC2s was Nile, which is network as a service. Well, that is your wheelhouse for sure. You're actually one of the co-founders. I think you guys just raised another $175 million or something. What's going on with that one?
Well, if you watch, Pankaj Patel is our CEO there. He was my head of engineering at Cisco, 28,000 people for a very long time.
I remember him. He's a rock star.
He's built a great engineering team around him from many of the tech startups here in the Valley on it. And he's got a disruption. The next new technology will be network as a service. Nobody understands you don't take traditional networking products and deliver them as a service. You have to do this with a clean slate of paper. You have to say, how do you make it easy to use? We made the internet too complex. You had to be a computer jockey to really navigate through it and use the technologies. And so what Pankaj is doing, and I'm honored to be a founder with him, is we're taking all the operational expenses, the complexity it out, and make it easy to consume, not having to do capital expenditures, but just consume the service as you move forward. I think it's going to be a major trend for the future. It's one that I'm very optimistic about, but it's startups that I'm optimistic about get major technology trends connected to business trends. Customers do not want to be tied into capitalization. They don't want to have to determine what type of device do they purchase when. They just want the network to work and be not operationally expensive. Same thing with AI. People want their call centers just to work well. They don't want it to be a negative for their customers, and they want to do it at lower expense and put their other resources back into areas that they have core competency in. So I try to pick what are the next major technology enablers going to do for key industries. So a business model change enabled by new technology like AI or a new capability network as a service type approach, that's where disruption occurs. Same thing on cybersecurity.
Yeah, and I like your categories. You know, we won't go into them all, but you guys are picking the right categories. And so if people are pitching you, what do you want to see from an entrepreneur?
It's a great question. You know, Dean, it's amazing how many times startups or even big companies ask you to say, here's what we're doing. What do you think?
Exactly.
At the end of their pitch, I'm still confused. What did they say?
Especially big companies are always confused what they said.
So what you got to do is, what I look for is, show me the business model change that is occurring. And I'm an enterprise business investor. Show me the new technology that enables it. Show me your leadership team, what culture you have, and culture is as important as strategy and vision. And show me that you want a coach and a partner. I'm not a VC typical investor. I'm more of a strategic partner and a coach as we do it. Take me to your top customers. Tell me why they like your product. And then show me what your sustainable differentiation is. Show me the growth opportunities that you have and how you're going to share that success, both not with your investors, but your investors, your partners, your employees, and society. And that's when I bet. How close you are to an inflection point. So if they're pitching me, just tell me that. It's very simple. How are you different? What do your customers think about you? What technology you're riding to make the change here? How are you going to disrupt the incumbents? But most important, you compete against innovation and you compete against changing yourself. You don't compete against a competitor. A competitor is a way you keep score. If you're competing against a competitor, you're looking out your rearview mirror.
That's probably the most sage advice that people are going to get this month here on the show. Hey, got a few minutes left. You mind getting personal a little bit?
I don't mind at all, Dean. I trust you completely.
I know you. I know your stories. You've gone through some good times and bad times. And anything you can share with everyone to just, kind of see how you kind of got through the fires? Kind of rebooted yourself?
Yeah, my dad and my mom were both doctors. Dad was a surprisingly good business leader for a doctor. And mom was internal medicine, psychiatry. So whatever broke, they could kind of help me through. But they taught me to deal with the world the way it is, not the way you wish it was. They taught me to think 5-10 years out, not next quarter, next year. And when I get into trouble, one of the most sage advice I got is determine how much was self-inflicted and how much was the market. And it's usually a combination of both. Then you've got to say, what are you going to do to fix it, including are you the right person to lead through that change? Then you regularly communicate with your employees, your customers, your partners on the change. You paint a picture of what you look like when you come out, your North Star for the future, get people motivated behind it. And that's how you handle your setbacks on it. Setbacks for me being dyslexic was really hard because my teachers, even though I had two amazing parents, said, I'm not going to graduate from high school. And because Mrs. Anderson helped me, a special teacher, when dyslexia wasn't understood, she taught me to take a weakness and make it a strength, including being scared to death of public speaking, Dean. I used to throw up before I do a customer presentation at IBM and speak publicly. I've learned how to take my weakness and make it a strength. 2001, dot-com bust. We went from doing everything right. We won every award, as you were kind to say in the introduction, imaginable. And we were the most valuable company in the world. And yet all of a sudden people were questioning, was Cisco, did we have a future? And was I the right leader? And maybe I was not. And leadership is lonely. And you've got to be realistic. Are you the right leader to change? And what are you going to do to change and address some of the issues are market driven, but a number are your own issues you had to change. You are more a product of how you handle your setbacks than you are your successes. And so I think as leaders go through that, and many of them are now doing that in the startup world, and many companies are being disrupted, I think you want to realize you've got to disrupt or you're going to be disrupted, and you want to be humble and treat people like you'd like to be treated yourself. But those are painful scenarios to go through. And I don't like talking about them. My hands sweat when I talk about dyslexia, Dean. That hasn't changed. It still is a fear for me.
Wow.
Sharing the story goes a long way. And mistakes I made in 2001 made me a better leader in 2008 when we powered through the Great Recession and we gained market share at a time everybody else lost it. But I learned from my mistakes in the decade leading up to 2001, and I try not to make the same mistakes twice. That'd be kind of my thoughts on how you handle setbacks. And it is lonely, and you're not sure if you're the right person, but you've got to decide, are you going to do it? And if so, then you put your heart and soul into it, and you give it everything you got.
Wow. I love that. And having been a CEO of myself of a dozen smaller companies, usually the guy that steps in when things are in trouble, I so resonate with that, because it's like you have to muscle up your confidence, and you overcame so much and went so far. And you've really rebooted yourself like 5 or 6 times. So thanks for sharing that, John. I really appreciate it.
My honor, Dean.
You've been listening to John Chambers, the CEO of JC2 and Chairman Emeritus at Cisco. This is Dean Tobias with the Reboot Chronicles. I want to thank you for joining us today. We'll see you soon. Thanks, John.